freckled and weathered. He has several days of stubble, and his hair is receding evenly towards the top of his head. He is wearing tracksuit bottoms and a thick hooded fleece pulled up tight around his neck. I can see his pride and joy, an old maroon Jaguar parked prominently on his front lawn, and know that somewhere across the estate are both his ex-wives, one of whom he still cares for deeply. I follow him into his tiny mobile home. The porch smells of smoke, and odd bits of carpet line the floor. He leads me through a miniature hallway and points to a faded leather couch. "Make yourself at home." He has a surprisingly soft West Country accent. "Right, thanks." I sit down and try to muster some sort of tact. "So," I say, as he joins me in the living room, "you used to think you were dead." If there was ever a brain that deserves to be in these pages, it is that which makes a person believe they are dead. I first came across the condition in 2011 during an interview with Villaner Ramachandran, who Time magazine had just placed on their list of 100 most influential people in the world. We were both in San Diego to attend the Society for Neuroscience's annual meeting, one of the biggest science conferences in the world, and I had been given the rare opportunity of a face-to-face interview. Thankful that he had remembered to turn up, he has a notoriously terrible memory, I quickly whisked him out of the press room and into a small adjoining corridor. As we walked, he turned to me. "You know, there are these patients who believe they are dead. They say they can smell rotting flesh, but that there's no point in suicide, because why bother when they're already dead?" It was his idea of small talk. I looked at him in surprise. "Yeah," he said, his eyes twinkling. "It's really spooky." While humans began imagining this scenario centuries ago, corpse-like creatures were the mainstay of the Viking afterlife, and dragas were the undead body of Norse mythology, Ramachandran was in fact referring to a clinical delusion of death that is known as Cotard syndrome, sometimes referred to as walking corpse disorder. The medical literature rarely mentions Cotards, but when it does, it always refers to the French neurologist Jules Cotard as the father of the condition, the person who first described it during the 1880s and by whose name it later became known. The young Cotard was said to have a serious and reflective personality. After studying at the Faculty de Medicine in Paris, he became close to the French philosopher Auguste Comte, a friendship thought to have sparked his intense interest in the mind. In 1864, Cotard became an intern at La Salpêtrière, a teaching hospital in Paris, famed for producing some of the world's greatest neurologists. There he became a passionate student for madness in its multiple forms. After a short time performing military service during the Franco-Prussian War, Cotard returned home, where he spent several years in a psychiatric clinic, later opening a clinic of his own in Vanves, a small but densely populated suburb of Paris. Having had the opportunity to study psychiatric disorders from all corners of the country, Cotard became particularly intrigued by severe delusions. It was then that he first described patients with délire de négations, which he characterised as a type of melancholic belief that leaves a person feeling as if certain parts of their body or aspects of their world have died, or in its most extreme form, that one does not exist at all. In 1882, he wrote a chapter for the Archives de Neurologie, which paints a vivid picture of the condition. "Patients," he said, "have no entrails, no brain, no head, they no longer eat, no longer digest, no longer dress, and in fact they resolutely refuse food and often retain their fecal matter. Some," he added, "believe it is their intellectual faculties that have died, that they are being transformed into half-wits, are prevented from thinking, are being told nonsense, and on occasion they even consider that their intelligence has been removed." Sometimes the delusion can relate to the outside world, in which patients imagine that they have no family, no country, that Paris has been destroyed, that the world no longer exists. No more than 100 cases of Cotard syndrome have since been identified. At least 5 of these, and probably several more, were described by Cotard himself in lectures and papers he produced throughout his career. One particular patient of his was the rather exotic-sounding Mademoiselle X. When Mademoiselle X was asked what she was called, she said that she did not have a name. When probed, she claimed she used to be called Catherine, but wished to speak no further about how she had lost her name. She said she had no age and had never had any parents. When Cotard asked Mademoiselle X and others like her if they suffered from headaches, stomach aches, or any pain in the body whatsoever, they answered simply that they had no head, no stomach, no body. Cotard also wrote about Madame C, who claimed that her throat had been removed, that she no longer had a stomach or any blood. Monsieur C, no apparent relation, refused to wear any clothes because his whole body was no more than a large nut. Monsieur A believed that he had no penis, no testicles, in fact, no longer had anything at all. When I started this book, I thought a lot about what Ramachandran had said. I asked several doctors whether they had ever heard of the condition. The few who had said they'd only ever read about it, and that the people who suffered from it had either passed away, in the more traditional sense, or were dotted around the world in psychiatric care homes, having never fully recovered. Then one day, out of the blue, along came Graham. He had been a patient of Adam Zeman, a neurologist at the University of Exeter. Zeman told me that he had been treating Graham, who had suffered from Cotard's for many years, but was now apparently in good fettle and entirely happy to talk to me. A few weeks passed while we got the go-ahead from Graham's psychiatrist, and then, as promised, Graham's telephone number landed in my inbox, which is how I came to be sitting on a leather couch, miles from home, listening to a middle-aged man talk calmly about his recent death. "So, you used to think you were dead." "That's right," Graham says, lowering himself onto the couch opposite, seemingly quite at ease. In the 1990s, Graham lived in the same bungalow, but led a very different life. He had two children and only one ex-wife. He worked for a company that provides drinking and wastewater for a corner of England. He was a contractor, installing water meters. He was going through his second divorce and over time became severely depressed. He stopped going to work, avoided his friends, and rarely left home. One day, Graham ran a bath for himself and stepped into it, holding a plugged-in hairdryer. "Was there something that happened that tipped you over the edge?" I asked gently. "I don't think so. I was just so low, you know. I don't know how I could have got so low. I don't really like to think about it," Graham replies. It's not clear what happened next. Graham remembers ringing his brother Martin in a panic. Martin phoned for an ambulance. Graham stayed in hospital for weeks, cared for by doctors who initially diagnosed him with severe depression. But unbeknown to them, his depression had morphed into something entirely different. "What happened while you were there?" I ask. "I just felt like I didn't have anything in my head," Graham says. "I was convinced that I didn't have a brain, that I'd done something to it in the bath. It was blank, just a blank mind." "And that's what you told the doctors?" "I told them that I didn't have a brain no more." These feelings persisted while doctors tried to work out what was wrong. Often they would attempt to rationalise. "Graham, how can you walk? How can you sit here talking to me if you don't have a brain?" they'd say. This dilemma puzzled Graham as much as his doctors. "It's difficult to describe," he says. "It was like my brain was a sponge that couldn't hold any water." He lists the side effects of death with surprisingly little feeling. "I didn't really have any thoughts, no emotions. I didn't feel anything. I couldn't smell anything either. I lost my sense of taste. Even my favourite cigarettes didn't give me a hit, and I'd been smoking those since I was 12. I gave them up just like that. Normally I'd have been climbing the walls. Nothing gave me pleasure anymore. I didn't even remember what pleasure felt like. I just had this blank mind and I knew, I couldn't say why, I just knew that I didn't have a brain anymore." "And at no point did you think, okay, I know I must have a brain because I'm sitting here breathing?" "No, I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know how I could breathe or talk when my brain was dead. I just knew it was." This was the challenge that faced Graham's doctors. He could speak, breathe, and walk, but was unable to incorporate those abilities into a sense of feeling alive. How, then, do you convince a person that they are alive when they claim overwhelming evidence to the contrary? Graham's doctors tried all sorts of pharmacological solutions, prescribing him antipsychotics and antidepressants, but nothing worked. A scan showed no problem with the anatomical structures in his brain, and no amount of psychotherapy made any difference. "It just reinforced what I already knew," says Graham. "I told the doctors that my brain was dead. They may as well have been giving me Smarties." They had reached an impasse. Graham wasn't going to convince his doctors of his death, nor could he be convinced that he was alive. So they all agreed that he could return home under the watchful eye of a community nurse and his brother. Graham points to the couch. "I sat right there, just like you are now," he says. "All day, for months. I didn't have anything to think about. Didn't want to do anything, say anything, see anyone. Just stared at that wall, like a vegetable. Somehow my body hadn't realised my brain was dead, but I knew it was. Horrible, really, thinking about it now. But that was that. That was that. I close my eyes and think about this unpleasant possibility for a moment. How did you cope?" I ask. "What could I do?" says Graham. "I was dead. I just accepted it." Although Cotard wrote extensively about patients like Graham, the medical community may have made a mistake in naming the disorder after him. In his book, Mental Disorder in Earlier Britain, Basil Clark touches upon the work of Levinus Lemnius, a Dutch physician. He describes some of Lemnius's patients, one of whom sounded very similar to Graham. Was it actually Lemnius who was the first to describe the disorder centuries earlier? To find out, I paid a visit to Cambridge University's Rare Books Room. It's a large and almost completely silent room, save for the scratching of the occasional pencil across paper. Pens are strictly forbidden here. My book was ready and waiting when I arrived, a tiny leather-bound thing, printed in 1581, entitled The Touchstone of Complexions by Levinus Lemnius. Carefully, I carried the old book to the back of the room and placed it on a plush velvet stand as instructed. I was hoping to find mention of Graham's disorder somewhere within its crinkled old pages. Lemnius was, by all accounts, a popular writer, having published work on astrology, length of life, and occult mysteries. The Touchstone of Complexions was a sort of early pop science account of different diseases and why they occur, and claimed to contain most easy rules whereby everyone may perfectly try and thoroughly know the exact state, habit, disposition and constitution of his body outwardly, as also the inclinations, affections, motions and desires of his mind inwardly. Had Lemnius known that Cotard's existed, he would no doubt have blamed it on an imbalance of the humoral system. Such was the accepted medical understanding of his time. Indeed, the four humours, black bile, yellow bile, blood and phlegm, and an exposition on their importance in keeping the human organism in balance, are the main subject matter of this tiny leather-clad book. In the final chapter, I eventually found what I was looking for. By this point, Lemnius had reached the brain and was spending some time on the different types of melancholy, paying special attention to patients who suffer from what he called a depression of the spirits. He picked out a particularly interesting case study. "A certain gentleman fell into such an agony and fool's paradise," he wrote, "that he thought himself dead and was in himself persuaded to be departed out of this life. The friends and acquaintances of this gentleman tried flattering and scolding him in an attempt to restore him to his former strength, but nothing worked. He rebutted everything they had to say and turned away any food they offered, affirming himself to be dead, and that a man in his state needed no sustenance or nourishment." That sounded familiar. Doctors had tried to get Graham to eat and drink, but he'd told them he had no need. He wouldn't have bothered with food at all if he hadn't been forced to consume something each day by his family. When the gentleman in Lemnius's anecdote refused any help, he ended up at the real death's door, so to speak. At this point, his friends came up with an ingenious plan. They dressed themselves in shrouds, cloth normally wrapped around corpses, and sat at a table in his parlour, spread with several platters of food. Upon seeing his friends, the man demanded to know who they were and what they were doing. They answered that they were all dead. "What, do dead men eat and drink?" "Yes," they replied, "and that shall thou prove true, if you will come and sit with us." Apparently, this peculiar brand of logic persuaded the man to feed himself rather well. Disappointingly, Lemnius makes no mention of whether he eventually recovered. Back in Graham's mobile home, I tell him of Lemnius's story. It seems to make him sad. He tells me that he owes a lot to his family, particularly his brother Martin. "He made sure I ate during the day," he says. "He still comes to see me every day to make sure I'm okay. It must have been awful for him to see me like that." I later asked to speak with Martin to hear his recollection of Graham's illness, but he declined. I asked Graham whether any of his friends knew anything about his condition. "No, I didn't tell anybody. It's kind of a weird thing to say to somebody, I ain't got no brain. My mates would have just said, yeah, we've known that for years. I didn't understand it myself. I couldn't go around telling everyone I was dead. They'd think I was mad." On the odd occasion that a case study of Cotard's appears in medical texts, it is often accompanied by disturbing descriptions of the patient's experiences. In one, a lady who believed she was in purgatory, having died but not yet moved on, poured acid all over herself, believing that to be the only way to rid herself of her body. This leads me to ask Graham why, as the weeks turned into months and then years, he didn't try to commit suicide again. "I remember trying to work all that out," he says. "I did consider it. It was awful, really. But the thing was, I believed if I tried to commit suicide again, put myself under a train or put my head on the line, well, it's like I told the nurse. I told her, I'm sure my head would still be there. I'd still be able to speak, because I'm already dead, so the train can't really kill me." Luckily for Graham, medicine has progressed enormously since the days of the Four Humours. A few months after his Cotard's began, Graham was referred to Adam Zeman, the neurologist who had orchestrated our initial introduction. Zeman consulted another neurologist called Stephen Lorries at the University of Liège in Belgium, because, as he once told me with a smile, I knew he liked weird things. "How could I forget," says Lorries, when I asked him about it. "It's the one and only time my secretary has ever said, you have to come and speak to this man because he's telling me he's dead." If there are two people that you want on your side when you think you're dead, it's these two. Over the course of his career, Lorries has performed some of the most fascinating experiments on the human mind, with somewhat startling results. His lab does all it can to understand, diagnose, and treat people who suffer from disorders of consciousness. Occasionally, that means discovering that people previously thought to be in a vegetative state with no awareness are in fact locked in, completely aware of their surroundings, but with no way of letting anyone know. In 2006, Lorries and his colleague Adrian Owen developed a test to check whether someone in an apparent vegetative state could in fact follow orders by inviting them to think about moving around their house or playing tennis. These two thoughts produce very different patterns of activity in the brain, which the team could identify using brain scans. Their first patient, a 23-year-old woman who had fulfilled all the criteria for vegetative state after a road traffic accident, was able to produce the two patterns of brain activity on request. Later, they discovered she was very much aware of her surroundings, despite not being able to move, because she was able to answer their questions by attributing the two different thoughts, thinking about moving around her house or playing tennis, to the words yes and no. Zeman, on the other hand, has concentrated his career on understanding the more bizarre disorders of consciousness, such as permanent déjà vu, that can occur as a result of epilepsy, or more recently, insomnia-induced transient amnesia, whereby people who are severely sleep-deprived, doctors, for example, perform complex activities like resuscitation, then completely forget they have done it. Together, the two neurologists have seen more kinds of consciousness than you might imagine could exist. It might sound strange to talk about different kinds of consciousness when most people think about either being conscious or not. But as we've seen in the previous two chapters, many aspects of our consciousness can take their leave. Tackling the subject of consciousness is not for the faint-hearted. It is a subject that the world's most brilliant thinkers, psychologists, neuroscientists, and philosophers alike have spent many centuries struggling to explain. Most scientists believe that our consciousness, or sense of self, arises from the behaviour of a vast assembly of brain cells that act in concert with the body. We can, in theory, map all this neural activity in complete detail, and in doing so explain all our behaviour entirely in terms of brain states. We can say, for instance, how the brain functions to produce memory and attention and colours. This is what scientists call the easy problem. But even if we understand the brain activity underneath all our behaviours, it still does not solve the hard problem. Why this brain activity results in our rich experience of colours and sounds, or the way pain feels, or the experience of lust. Our conscious sense of self has stubbornly resisted all attempts to understand and describe its existence. The neuroscientist Anil Seth says that if we want to understand consciousness, we should aim our sights somewhere in between the easy and hard problem and investigate how certain properties of consciousness arise using measurable biological mechanisms. For instance, we can start by trying to pinpoint exactly what distinguishes a conscious brain from an unconscious one. Seth says it doesn't seem to have anything to do with how many neurons are active. We know this because the cerebellum at the back of the brain contains far more brain cells than the cortex, but can be completely missing without affecting consciousness at all. In 2014, a 24-year-old woman was admitted to the Chinese PLA General Hospital of Jinan Military Area Command in Shandong Province, complaining of dizziness and nausea. She told doctors she'd had problems walking steadily for most of her life, and her mother reported that her speech only became intelligible at the age of 6. Doctors scanned her brain and immediately identified the source of the problem. Her entire cerebellum was missing. So if it's not to do with the number of neurons, what else might distinguish the conscious from the unconscious brain? A landmark experiment by Adanawa Casali at the University of Milan and his colleagues recently tackled this question by stimulating the brain using short pulses of magnetic stimulation. When they did this to people under anaesthetic or who were asleep but not dreaming, it created a wave of activity that flowed a short distance from the point of stimulation. However, when they did the same thing in people who were conscious, the wave travelled much further over the surface of the cortex. Anil Seth later described this technique as like banging on the brain and listening to it echo. Casali and his team have begun to use this echo to create what they have fondly termed a consciousness meter, a way of working out whether a human, or indeed any kind of animal, is conscious or not. We can also pinpoint key brain regions responsible for consciousness. For example, there appears to be a group of regions towards the front and top of the brain called the frontoparietal network that are vital for consciousness to arise. This network can be further divided into two. Activity in areas along the outside of the frontal and parietal lobes seems to be correlated with our awareness of things in our external world, the smells, tastes, and sounds around us. Activity in the second network, distributed among the inner parts of the two lobes, is correlated with our awareness of our inner self, the perception of our body, and our mental imagery, for example. When we are concentrating on our external environment, we see the associated network increase in activity as the other decreases. The opposite holds true when we consider our internal self. In recent years, scientists have also questioned whether our consciousness needs something akin to an orchestra conductor, something that directs proceedings. One proponent of this idea was Francis Crick, a pioneering neuroscientist who early in his career identified the structure of DNA. Just days before he died in the summer of 2004, Crick was working on a paper with his colleague Christoph Koch at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, in which he hypothesized that this conductor would need to integrate information rapidly across distinct regions of the brain and bind together information arriving at different times to make sense of the world. For example, information about the smell and color of a flower, its name, and a memory of the date can be bound into one conscious experience of being handed a rose on Valentine's Day. The pair suggested that the claustrum, a thin sheet-like structure that connects to several other diverse regions, is perfectly suited to this job. The claustrum, deeply embedded towards the centre of the brain, is rarely exposed to scientific investigation. However, in 2014, Mohamed Kobesi at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and his colleagues were using electrodes to record brain activity in a woman with epilepsy when they realised that one of their electrodes was placed upon the claustrum. When the team zapped the area with high-frequency electrical impulses, the woman lost consciousness. She stopped reading and stared blankly into space. She was awake, but not aware. She didn't respond to auditory or visual commands, and her breathing slowed. As soon as the stimulation stopped, she immediately regained consciousness with no memory of the event. The same thing happened every time the area was stimulated during 2 days of experiments. It's difficult to say that one area of the brain is more important than another in triggering our conscious experiences. I like to think about it as a car. There are many parts of a car that are needed to make it run. Some are more vital than others. You definitely need petrol and an engine and a key or fob, for instance. Perhaps these parts of the car are like neurons, the frontoparietal network and the claustrum. Without one or the other, you don't have any consciousness. But there are several other aspects of a car that make it run properly. Windscreen wipers, a steering wheel, brakes, which I liken to the bits of the brain that help us have agency over our body, that integrate our internal and external worlds, that help us experience colour and sound. When one of these aspects of the car goes wrong, we can still drive, but something doesn't feel right. A waft of stale smoke inside Graham's house reminds me of something he'd said to me in passing. That even in the midst of his disorder, he still occasionally smoked the odd cigarette, regardless of the fact that he didn't get a hit from them. Just for something to do, like, he'd said. Something in Graham's manner, in his recollection of this habit, puzzles me. Why, if you truly think you're dead, you don't eat, you don't drink, would you bother having a cigarette? Unless, of course, you still had some kind of craving. It crosses my mind, probably as it had some of his doctors, that I should be taking everything he was saying with a bigger pinch of salt. Just as this thought occurs to me, Graham reaches down to the bottom of his trousers, rolls up the hem, and shows me his legs. "They all fell out, you know," he says. "What did?" I ask, taken aback. "My hair. I used to have nice hairy legs." "What, and now you don't?" I say, staring at his naked ankles. "Nothing. They all fell out, just like a plucked chicken." There is a moment's pause. "I should probably become a diver," he says, his face breaking into the first smile I have seen that morning. "What did the doctors say?" "They couldn't explain it. They couldn't explain any of it. I kept on telling them that I'd fried my brain in the bath, but they just wouldn't listen." And just like that, I believed in him. Zeman, on the other hand, had been convinced of the legitimacy of Graham's claims the moment he met him. "I believed him, yes, absolutely," he told me when I later admitted that I'd briefly had my doubts. Lorries had needed more convincing. "He's saying his brain is dead. It's very strange when you interact with him. You think it's impossible that he believes this. Of course you think twice. You think, is he tricking me?" Both researchers, however, were sure of one thing. They needed another look inside Graham's brain. Something had altered Graham's sense of self, and they wanted to find out what. Inside the Cyclotron Research Centre at the University of Liège, Graham was placed into a machine that resembled a giant white donut. There, his brain was analysed using positron emission tomography, more commonly known as a PET scan. This type of scan monitors all the metabolic activity in the brain. That's all the different cellular processes that are going on at any one time. You'd expect to see quite a lot of activity in someone who is awake. "What we saw was shocking," said Lorries. "Metabolic activity across large areas of Graham's brain was so low that it resembled someone who was asleep or in a coma. I've never seen anyone who was on his feet, who was interacting with people, with activity that low," Lorries said. "And I've been doing this a very long time. Seeing this pattern in someone who is awake is quite unique to my knowledge." With what's known about echoes and the amount of activity that should be taking place around the brain of someone who's conscious, it just didn't add up. When Zeman and Lorries wrote a paper about Graham, they entitled it, Brain Dead, Yet Mind Alive. While there was nothing wrong with the structure of Graham's brain, his PET scan had shown something very different. Firstly, his frontoparietal network was low in activity, but there were two other regions of the brain that were also problematic. The first was what's called the default mode network, a collection of neurons that form part of the frontal parietal network, but also includes some regions of the temporal lobe. Our default mode network is switched on when we're not concentrating on anything. It's associated with mind wandering, daydreaming, and self-referential thoughts. It allows us to think about ourselves, to recollect our past, and plan for our future. This ability to think about the things that are happening to us helps us make sense of the world. For instance, right now I can smell bread because I put my bread maker on a few hours ago. I can hear a strange clicking behind my head because my neighbours are doing DIY. My back is aching because my posture is bad and I've been hunched over my computer for too long. My world is making perfect sense. I have my default mode network to thank for that. Graham's default mode network, however, was barely functioning, which might explain why he had such a reduced sense of self. But why did he come to the conclusion that he was dead? You might think that believing in your own death, despite the presence of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, would require exceptional effort. But perhaps not. The brain hates to be confused. Just as we have seen many times in this book already, when it is faced with conflicting information, it tries very hard to make sense of the new scenario and generally lands upon the simplest narrative to explain an abnormal experience. It's just like the rubber hand illusion that we saw in Chapter 6. When we see a brush stroking a rubber hand and feel that same brushstroke on our own hand, our brain comes to the conclusion that the rubber hand must belong to us. We can demonstrate just how easily the brain can fool itself in people who have a split brain, which happens when the corpus callosum, the region of tissue that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, is severed. This is usually because it has been surgically removed to treat epileptic seizures. Unfortunately, some of our abilities are located in just one side of our brain. As we've seen earlier in this book, our basic language skills are normally controlled by an area in the left hemisphere. Because split-brain patients don't have any nerves connecting the two hemispheres, they cannot pass information back and forth between the two. So if you show them something only in their left visual field, which is processed in the right side of the brain, they won't be able to describe it, because the information won't be passed from the right side of the brain to the language centres in the left. Let's say you show their left eye a picture of a snowy field, and their right eye a chicken. Then get them to pick two corresponding images. In this classic experiment, the split-brain patient usually picks something like a snow shovel and a chicken's claw. But ask them to describe why they picked each picture, and their answer is unusual. They would say something like, "I picked the shovel because I could use it to clean out the chicken coop." The language area of the brain has access only to what the right eye has seen, the chicken, and has made up a story for why they have picked a picture of a shovel. Here, then, you can see just how easily one's own brain can tell tales, albeit ones it believes are perfectly true. Simply put, Graham's conclusion that he was dead was likely the most straightforward narrative to explain his bizarre new experience of the world. Once he had come to this conclusion, though, why did he not dismiss this ludicrous idea out of hand? In order to do so, Graham would have to use the brain systems that allow us to evaluate our beliefs. Various pieces of evidence suggest that these brain systems exist in the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the second area of Graham's brain that was particularly low in activity. As Zeman explained it to me, how can you rationalise with someone if the part of their brain responsible for rationalising has become irrational? I asked Graham what he thought of his brain scans when he saw them. "I didn't think anything," he says. "I'd never seen one before. I didn't know what it showed, just that it showed I had this thing they called Cotard's." Whether this label gave him any solace is unclear. While it told him that the doctors understood he had a disorder, it didn't give him any self-awareness or new tools to cope with the problem. It didn't change the fact that I thought I was dead, he says. It was just a word they used to describe my weird brain. In the year that followed, Graham spent most of his time either at his mother's house or sitting staring at the wall in his tiny bungalow. There was only one other place he would visit, the local graveyard. Sometimes, he tells me, he would spend the whole day there. I just felt it was where I ought to be, you know, he says. He would walk around the graves, trying his best to understand his overwhelming urge to be buried. It was the nearest thing to death that I could get. I thought, I'm brain dead anyway, so I'm not going to lose out on anything. I might as well stay up here. I felt like I was at home there. On more than one occasion, Graham would go missing and his worried family would call the police. Each time they found him in the middle of the cemetery, happy to spend the rest of his days in a place dedicated to the dead. At that very moment, on the other side of Europe, there was someone who could sympathise with Graham's condition. She was a middle-aged lady, let's call her Mary, who had just been rushed into University Hospital in Stockholm, screaming. The doctors and nurses were unable to calm her, and she refused to tell them what was wrong. Mary's medical notes showed a history of kidney failure, and that she'd recently been treated for shingles with an injection of acyclovir. Her doctors decided it was best to put her on dialysis, which would wash out any toxins that may have built up in her blood and that might be causing her pain. An hour later, Mary had found her voice. She said the reason she was so upset was that she was sure she was dead. The doctors tried to reassure her and continued her dialysis. 2 hours later, she said, I'm not quite sure whether I'm dead anymore, but I'm still feeling very strange. After another 2 hours, the woman told the staff, I'm pretty sure I'm not dead anymore, but my left arm is definitely not mine. Within 24 hours, her nihilistic delusions had all but disappeared. The Swedish pharmacologist Anders Helden and his colleague Thomas Linden were intrigued by Mary's experience. Helden said he had started to notice other cases of transient cotards appearing and then disappearing in several patients with kidney failure. He scoured Swedish medical records and discovered 8 people who had been in an identical situation over the past 3 years. They all had a similar story, some kind of kidney failure and treatment with a drug called acyclovir, injected directly into their blood supply. You might recognise the name. Acyclovir is a common drug used to treat cold sores. When the pair reanalysed samples of blood taken from all of their patients, they discovered high levels of CMMG, a molecule produced when the body breaks down acyclovir. Most patients had also developed very high blood pressure. I asked Helden what he made of it all. We have a feeling that CMMG is causing some kind of constriction of the arteries in the brain, he said. Somehow, the parts of the brain affected by this constriction arouse in patients a transient belief that they are dead. I asked Seaman whether we could say for sure that Graham's condition occurred as a result of his electrocution. Although it seemed far too coincidental to be much else, I know that such correlations don't sit well with scientists. Zeman said it's impossible to say for sure. Without stronger evidence, a before and after brain scan, for instance, we should be hesitant to say that Graham's suicide attempt caused his delusions. I wondered whether you might expect to see such strange activity in the brain of others with severe depression. Could Graham's brain be an extreme example of this more common condition? The symptoms of depression are similar in many ways to Graham's. Hopelessness, loss of interest in life, lack of movement and a detachment from the rest of the world. The causes of depression are complex and are yet to be fully understood, but the most recent evidence suggests that the condition may be a result of a lack of serotonin, which is involved in stabilising mood, and a lack of glutamate, which causes the finger-like tips of neurons to become shrivelled so they can no longer pass messages around the brain. I asked Seaman if he thought Graham could have been on the extreme end of this diagnosis, but he said he wouldn't expect to see Graham's brain changes in depression, even if severe. The pattern of low metabolic activity was much more acute and widespread than classically reported in major depressive disorders. Of course, with a single case study, one can never be sure, he said. But Graham's brain changes were exceptional. There may not be causal evidence to prove that Graham's electrocution triggered his disorder, but we do know that it's not the first time a jolt to the head has led to cotards. In the late 18th century, Charles Bonnet, whom we met in Chapter 5, wrote a brief report on one of his patients. He described her as an honourable old lady of almost 70 years. This woman was in her kitchen preparing a meal when a draught came through the door and hit her on the neck, causing her to experience sudden paralysis on one side of her body, as if hit by a stroke. For 4 days, she was unable to move or speak. When her speech returned, she demanded that her friends should dress her in a shroud and place her in a coffin since she had died. She became agitated when her daughter and her friends tried to persuade her otherwise and scolded them for not offering her this last service. Eventually, they did as she requested and laid her out in a shroud. She tried to make herself look as neat as possible, inspecting the seams and expressing dissatisfaction with the colour of the linen. According to Bonnet, this woman slowly recovered, although her delusions returned several times a year. It was with little fanfare that Graham's delusions also eventually lifted. He can't pinpoint the moment he first became aware that he felt better. Whether it was the right concoction of antidepressants or just a matter of time, his delusion drifted away 3 years after they began. "At some point, I just came to thinking, this is bloody ridiculous. I've got to have a brain," he tells me. Graham's doctors put his recovery down to a combination of drugs and general brain repair. Graham was taking lithium, imipramine, and amisulpride, which all modulate chemicals, including serotonin and dopamine, that are vital for controlling the passage of activity around the brain, and in doing so can improve mood and help treat psychotic behaviour. "Gradually I just felt a bit more like myself," Graham says. "Only sometimes I felt a bit dead, but most of the time it was just me again." He pauses and takes a sip from a mug, which informs me that he is the best granddad in the world. He points to a picture on top of a side table and smiles. "Lovely my grandchildren are, good as gold." "Do you see them often?" I ask. He seems surprised at the question. His simple, fairly emotionless answers to my questions so far had given the impression of his being a bit of a loner. "All the time. I see them every week. Go round for lunch on a Sunday and see them all." "What about other people? Do you go out much now?" I ask. "Not on holiday. I'm a bit old for that. But I go down to the club every week, see my mates." "Do you still see your ex-wife, too?" I say. "Yeah, every week." He quickly adds, "The first one, not the second one." His tone turns wistful. I'm not sure what went wrong there, to be honest. I should never have let her go. Although I've been in his house all morning, talking about a subject that seems, to me, to be rife for self-examination, I'm struggling to understand exactly how Graham feels about his strange experiences. He seems to find it difficult to express his feelings, and is somewhat disengaged from his past. At one point he tells me that he hopes his tale will help other people who find themselves in a similar situation. It's a sweet sentiment, but he doesn't seem to realise quite how unusual his experience was. "I suppose," he says, when I point this out to him. I wonder whether this was just Graham, a man of few words, or whether the lack of engagement is linked to his condition. "Do you feel any different now?" I ask him. "Did the cotards change you in any way?" "Sometimes I wonder, am I different from who I used to be? I don't know. Some of my mates sometimes say, 'You ain't your normal self today.' And I think, am I not? Who am I? What's different?" He pauses again to consider the past, and I'm struck by what seems to be a moment of discomfort, the strongest emotion I'd seen so far over the memories of his condition. "It was just bizarre, you know. How could I have felt so odd?" he says. "Just sounds funny now I talk about it." I wonder, not for the first time that day, whether Graham would ever truly understand the extent to which his cotards had changed his life. The only thing he was sure of was his appetite. It never returned. "It's the only thing that is left over from the cotards," he says. I used to eat regular meals. Now I could take it or leave it. I never feel hungry. I ask him if that was it, an empty stomach, all that remained of the disorder. He hesitates for a moment before answering. You know, sometimes I still get funny thoughts now and then. I'm sitting there sometimes, and I'll suddenly feel a little bit dead. Just every now and then it happens, and then it goes away. Out of the window, I catch sight of Martin, arriving for his daily rendezvous with his brother, and I gather up my stuff to leave. As I make my way back to the car, I spot the old man in the cap. He was back outside, squirting at another hardy weed that had popped up between a crack in the pavement. I wave at him and smile. I leave the estate and drive home deep in thought. Graham epitomises everything that is so mysterious about consciousness and our sense of self. Here we have a man who can walk, talk and breathe, things that should capture the essence of being conscious. Yet for some time, those basic aspects of life were not enough to create a full sense of existence. It is desperately frustrating that the one thing we are unable to comprehend is our ability to comprehend anything in the first place. Perhaps it is because, as the late philosopher Gilbert Rye put it, in searching for the self, one cannot simultaneously be the hunter and the hunted. We will always find it hard to examine our own minds when they are the thing that is doing the examining. We might never solve this mystery, but I take solace in the fact that disorders like Cotard's offer a little glimmer of hope that this may not be the case. For instance, as a result of Heldon's acetylcholine studies, there is now, in theory, a way to turn Cotard's on and off at will. Alone, it won't reveal the wizard behind the curtain, or give us all the answers we seek, but it might just propel us another step forward in an endless voyage towards understanding the most complex mystery of the human brain. Chapter 9. Joel. Feeling Other People's Pain. Joel Salinas was minding his own business in a lecture theatre when he felt someone's hand around his throat. The sensation took him by surprise. It lasted for just a second before he noticed the lecturer standing at the front of the theatre. He had his hand around his throat and was rubbing it softly. "It's times like that," says Joel, "when this weird trait can really catch you off guard." A slight, handsome 32-year-old with brown eyes and a soft voice, Joel grew up in Miami to Nicaraguan parents who had come to the US seeking asylum. He lived in a Spanish household, learning English from watching TV. His childhood was relatively straightforward, although there were times when people might have mistaken his precociousness for autism. In fact, unlike many children with autism, he didn't find it difficult to empathise with others or to understand their behaviour. He knew only too well what other people were thinking or feeling, because whatever they felt, he felt it too. A scratch of the head, a frown, a slap on the wrist, if he saw it, he felt the same sensations on his own body. Have you ever watched a painful tackle on the football pitch and felt a twist in your stomach, or felt sad at the sight of someone upset? If so, you have experienced empathy. It's generally something we cannot avoid. The thoughts, feelings, and physical movements of others subtly leak into us, affecting our own thoughts and behaviour. It's a fundamental component of human society, one that we are typically unaware of, and that relies on a complex system of mirror-like activity in the brain. In 1992, Giacomo Rizzolatti, an Italian neurophysiologist at the University of Parma, and his colleagues discovered a group of neurons in the brain that fired in the same way both when a monkey was grasping a peanut and when it was watching a researcher grasp a peanut. These mirror neurons were first identified in the premotor cortex, a region responsible for planning and coordinating actions, and later in other areas of the brain, such as those which process our sense of touch. What makes this mirroring special is that when we see someone performing an action or pulling a face, we don't just see their actions. Our brain, in a sense, feels them too. It is thought that this enables us to internalise another person's actions as if we are the agent in charge of those actions. Over the past 20 years, the existence of mirror neurons in humans has been validated in a number of studies, and they have been described as the driving force behind our great leap forward in human evolution. They are considered by many to be vital to our ability to understand and interpret the actions of others and to empathise with another person's mental state. For most of us, this mirroring takes place under the radar. It allows us to empathise with, but not literally feel, what another person is experiencing, because signals from other areas of the brain allow us to distinguish between things that happen to us and things that happen to others. But some people's mirroring mechanism is unusually active, which results in them experiencing tactile sensations and emotions from seeing those same sensations happen to other people. These can be so sudden and so strong that they are sometimes indistinguishable from the real thing. The condition is called mirror touch synesthesia. It differs from other kinds of synesthesia that we have seen earlier in that it can have far more visceral results. The first mirror touch synesthete was discovered by Sarah Jane Blakemore, a neuroscientist at University College London. Blakemore was delivering a lecture in which she mentioned anecdotal accounts of people who could feel other people being touched on their own bodies. At the end of the lecture, a puzzled woman in the audience came up to her and said, "Isn't it normal to feel other people's touch?" In a paper subsequently published in the journal Brain, Blakemore reported that she had scanned the woman's brain and showed that her mirror neuron system was much more active than in other people of her age when she observed touch. In the same paper, Blakemore also describes a man who had suffered a stroke that resulted in paralysis and loss of sensation to the left side of his body. If his body was hidden from view, he was unable to feel any kind of tactile sensation. However, as soon as he was able to see his body being touched, he claimed he was able to feel the touch. It was the first sign that tactile stimulation isn't always necessary for us to perceive the sensation of touch. In some conditions, vision alone is sufficient. I was desperate to know what it was like to experience such a condition. So one freezing morning in January, hours before a blizzard buried much of the east coast of America, I travelled to Boston to meet Joel. Joel had experienced mirror touch synesthesia for as long as he could remember. But what is most remarkable about his story is his career choice. He is a doctor, which means that he spends the day sharing the sensation of painful injuries, turbulent emotions, and even death. Joel and I are seated in the gigantic lobby of what was once the Charles Street Jail. Famous for housing Malcolm X, the prison was one of Boston's most iconic landmarks. Now transformed into the 300-room Liberty Hotel, the building has retained a lot of its chilling charisma. Each floor has wrought iron railings which overlook an opulent central rotunda. Each prison wing now hosts guests who can afford to pay top dollar for such a well-located hotel. There is something reassuringly familiar about Joel. He is smiley and genuine and an easy conversationalist. Each time I laugh, he laughs too. He is self-depreciating and eloquent and all the things that make you immediately want to be someone's friend. Perhaps I shouldn't be too surprised, since Joel's ability to understand my feelings is far beyond that of a normal stranger. If I were to place my hand in my lap, Joel would feel the sensation of a hand on his own lap. If I bite my lip, he feels a tingle in the same spot. If I were to push a coin along my arm, he'd feel the flatness running along his arm. If I were to poke my leg with a toothpick, he'd feel the pointedness on his leg. He describes the feeling as an imperfect replica of the real thing, an echo of a sensation. But it's not just other people's touch that Joel can feel, but their emotions too. When he sees someone looking puzzled, he too feels confused. If someone's angry, the emotion boils up in him as well. Settled into some comfy sofas in the corner of the lobby, Joel and I order coffee. I ask him to take me back to his childhood. "Sure," he says. "I'd probably have been described as an emotionally precocious and hypersensitive kid." He wasn't aware of his mirror touch synesthesia growing up, but looking back, he believes it definitely had an influence on his behaviour. He preferred to hang out with adults rather than children, for a start. "I think it was because I could take on board their emotional experiences," he says. So you absorbed their emotions and enjoyed feeling what adults were feeling? Yeah, I think that must have been it. It wasn't just the happy, sad, scared, angry emotions that you mainly think about as a kid. When I was around adults, I could experience all these other emotions. Intrigue, distance, impetuousness. They're words that I wouldn't have known at the time,